It's a blessing to assemble with you all, with friends and family that we get to see on a regular basis, and friends and family we don't get to see that often. Matthew chapter 10 is our text. We're going to continue our way moving through this book this morning, 5 through 42. So I encourage you to open your text to that place if you haven't already. This is an interesting, long section of Scripture to me, because what Matthew could have said after verse 4, where he gives the list of the apostles, ending with Judas Iscariot, verse 5 could have read something like this. Jesus called his 12 together, and he talked with them for a long time about what they needed to understand about the mission that he's sending them out on, period, move on to another story. But instead, the vast majority of chapter 10 goes into very great detail on what he talked to them about and how he trained these guys who were mentioned at the beginning before he sent them out. And so it strikes me that because all of this is in the Gospel of Matthew, that this is not recorded for us merely to say, this is just instructions for them, because it's here for us to read. Therefore, I think there's a whole lot of applications that we can draw out of this original message for the apostles that relates to the mission that we are sent out on and the kind of work that we are supposed to do in the world. And all of these instructions, I think, center on the phrase that we see there in verse 39. That the title of the sermon is taken from. That if you want to be Jesus's guy, Jesus's woman, what you're going to have to do is just completely lose, give up yourself so that you can find it. Because somebody who tries to do the opposite actually loses themselves. So the king calls upon you and me to give up what you cannot keep in order to gain what you cannot lose. We'll circle back around to that at the end. But let's start here in verse 5, and let's start working through the things that he tells them about what to expect, about the attitudes they need to have going forward. I think we can learn some interesting things here. Notice in there are some limits that Jesus places on the scope of their mission. So he says to them very, very distinctly and clearly, I'm not sending you out to the world right now. This is training wheels, period. And so don't go to Samaria. I think this is the only time Samaria is even mentioned in the Gospel of Matthew. Don't go to Samaria. Don't go to the Gentile people. That's going to come later on. But just stay in Israel, heal sick bodies here, cast out demons, preach your hearts out amongst your own people in your own backyard. I was fortunate enough as a teenager to go several years to a young men's Bible camp in the state of Alabama. And I don't know if the name Sewell Hall means anything to anybody in this room or if anybody knows him. But he was one of the older gentlemen, older preachers, who was there trying to equip us youngsters to serve. And the first sentence there on that point is what he said to us in one of those teaching sessions. Preach at home before you preach in Rome. And I think that's the idea that Jesus is getting across here. Eventually, they're going to preach in Rome, literally. At the end of the book of Acts, Paul is in chains, but he's there in the belly of the beast, in the empire, the capital city. But long before that happens, what you got to do is you got to start with the people nearest to you before God uses you in other places. That's Matthew 28. That's going to come, but the gospel is to the Jew first, Romans 1, and then also to the Greek, but that is later. And this is kind of thing that we see happening with Bible characters throughout the storyline of Scripture. Because what was Joseph before he was second in charge of all of Egypt? Well, he was the God-fearing guy in the prison who swept the floor and took out the garbage when he was supposed to. And then eventually he becomes overseer of the prison. Eventually he becomes overseer of one of the most powerful nations in the world at the time. Think about Daniel. Who was he before he became the ruler over the province of Babylon and the chief prefect over all of the wise men? He was the exiled kid who was quietly making arrangements with the guy who was over him to not defile himself with the king's food. Even Jesus himself follows this same trajectory, because what was he for the first 30 years of his life before he eventually ascends to the heavens and sits at the right hand of God? He's just a guy in a podunk town making really, really good tables and chairs. That's who he was. So the point of this is not you too can go from rags to riches. The point of this is you serve in little ways. And then as God sees what you do with that, he puts more and more responsibility into your lap so that you can serve in bigger and bigger ways. And that's what we see repeatedly in teachings to servants of God. We're going to see this in Matthew 25. I'll put that up on the screen. Jesus says flat out, if you're faithful over a little bit, he's going to put you over much. But you have to start small. For example, in a local church setting, in 1 Timothy 3, we're told about elders, shepherds in a local church. Where do you have to start? If you want to be a shepherd over an entire congregation of sheep, where do you first have to begin? It starts with the household, doesn't it? Shepherding your family first, before you even think about shepherding a whole bunch of sheep that you're not even related to by blood. You figure out how to walk with your children first. You teach them. You play and pray with them. You laugh with them. You cry with them. You bind up their wounds. You shape their hearts. You be there for them. The home is the proving ground for a man in God's spiritual family. Because if someone does not know how to manage his own household, how will he take care of God's church? Paul asks in that part of the letter. Rhetorical question. He won't know how to do that. And so if you want to be someone who has a broad influence for good, and you have a Jabez-like attitude, that's a good thing. But are you faithful in the little things? You want to be somebody who others go to for wisdom and advice? How's your daily Bible reading? How's your prayer life? Start small. You want to be more evangelistic? You want to be able to know how to more effectively talk to other people outside of these walls who desperately need Jesus. What do kitchen table conversations look like inside your home? Does Jesus get brought up? Are you talking about spiritual things with your own spouse, with your kids? That's where it begins. Start working in Israel before you extend out to Gentile Samaritan lands. That's the principle here, which I think is a powerful one. Something else that we see here in this first section in 5 through 15, I think is really, really neat. Because I think what he's teaching them and he's teaching us is that when you're productive in your ministry, your service, kind of work for God, that is coming from God, that productivity. It is not coming from you accumulating a storehouse of supplies to take with you. and that God is going to provide the nourishment you need on the road. These instructions seem really strange, don't they? When he's coaching them, he says, I want you to take a trip, but I don't want you to pack anything. No suitcases, no extra bag, no money belt. In fact, don't even expect to receive a bunch of financial rewards as you go out and you do this work. Give without pay, because you have received me without pay. And so don't take a whole bunch of equipment with you. This is all feeding into the biblical thought stream that runs throughout the Bible of when you accumulate, fill in the blank, whatever it is, it's not sinful, it's not wrong to have a bunch of riches, it's not wrong to have a bunch of knowledge. But what do riches and knowledge in abundance tend to do with our hearts? It tends to say to us, you can be pretty self-sufficient because you have this. And so God then becomes this person in the background of my life that I really only go to in the dire situations when my storehouse runs dry. But what were the Israelites supposed to do with manna in Exodus 16? You remember that? God put it outside of their tents, and he specifically told them, you just need to gather what you need for today. And if they ended up gathering more than that, you remember what happened to the manna? It bred worms and it stank, and they had to get rid of it anyway, and they couldn't hold on to it. Give us this day our daily bread. That's where that originally comes from. And you remember what Jesus has to say about amassing wealth? It's very difficult for those who have money to enter the kingdom of God, Mark 10:23. Remember what Paul says about accumulating knowledge. Knowledge does what? Puffs up. But love builds up. I like the way the ESV translates that in 1 Corinthians 8, verse 1. And that is coming from a guy who had a lot of knowledge himself. The Apostle Paul was very well educated. But don't pack a bunch of things when you go. But if the apostles aren't going to take a lot of things with them, how are they going to survive? How are they going to do their job on this trip? Well, they're going to have to depend on the generous hospitality of the people that they are with, who they stay with, who they are serving. This is such an interesting thing because this does a couple of different things for them. Number one, it obviously drives them closer to God, who's sending them out. But also, it moves them into a deeper relationship with the people who are in front of them because they don't have a lot of stuff with them in the bag. They don't even have a bag. So they need these people to nourish them. We get some interesting applications from this, I think. And the first one is, don't feel like you have to be 100%, 90%, 80%, 70, 60, 50 in order to throw yourself into some work that needs doing amongst the people of God, amongst Israel. But there's a temptation there that we're all going to face because we're going to see needs, and I really appreciate. So I did start bawling during that song, but because that song talks about, and I think in the second verse that there is an overwhelming number of needs that you can look out and see around you, and we're finite in all kinds of different ways, so you're going to feel that sometimes, like I do. That emotionally or physically or financially or in some other way, I just don't feel up to, I don't have my ducks in a row to do this thing, help this person, meet this need. And that if I can just pack a money belt, if I can pack some extra clothes and another staff, then I can do that later. But Jesus would say, use what you have. And even if it's not much, guess who I am? I'm the God who provides all strength. And the other neat thing about this is that if you are looking for nourishment, emotional nourishment, physical nourishment, nourishment in some way. How are you going to get that? How are you going to find that? Remember how the Old Testament priests and the Levites, how did they survive? They didn't have extensive territories like all the other tribes did. The priests and the Levites survived by the sacrifices that the Israelites would bring to the tabernacle, to the temple, and they would get a portion of all of those things. They were nourished by the people that they served. That's a prototype for the servants of Jesus and what we're doing amongst others who love Jesus and even those who don't yet but can. You know, it's interesting. Sometimes I read news articles that pop up in my feed about how there's this massive loneliness epidemic in our country. And I'm sure that that's at least partially true, and I'm sure that there are a whole lot of underlying reasons for that, structural changes in our culture, the digital world, what have you, whole lot behind that. But if you're somebody who feels lonely and isolated, doesn't this get at the root of the answer to that problem? Go find somebody to serve. Go find somebody to help and love and make that person your friend. Not your project, but your friend. And I've heard Laura talk about that sometimes, and I totally agree with that idea. That's the idea embedded in this text. Draw your nourishment from the person in front of you who you're trying to pour into. If you let them, they will be your friend too. And then you won't be as isolated and lonely as you were before you stepped into God's work. So this is a powerful point that we see here. When we go to 16 through 25, he's talking about the need for endurance. Verse 16 is probably a verse that most of us in here have read or heard before, but have you ever stopped to picture that scene? Have you ever stopped to imagine yourself as the sheep in that illustration? So your shepherd calls you over as a sheep, and the shepherd says, okay, so there's a big meadow over there with a pack of 100 wolves in it. And they're all chomping with their mouths. They all look really hungry. And I want you to go trot out there and kind of just plop yourself in the middle of all of those wolves. And I'll be here. I'll be watching over you. But you go out there and you do that. Would you think that your shepherd had lost his mind? Or would you trust your shepherd in that situation? I think that's what Jesus is saying here, is the world, broadly speaking, wants to eat you alive. And so you need to go out there and you need to draw people out of it. And you do need to be smart. You don't need to be dumb. Be like a serpent, not the Genesis 3 serpent who's going to cause others to stumble, but have cunning like a serpent does, but also be innocent and holy in what you do, and know that you're going to be under the eye of God in all this. The Spirit is going to be speaking through you. You know, one of the dominant themes of the Scriptures is that the world at large is going to hate you, and that you should not be surprised about that. Jesus talks about it. Hebrews talks about it. John talks about it. Peter talks about it. It's all over the place. And here he says, you'll be hated by all for my name's sake. Perhaps even, verse 21, by close family members. And it's going to hate you, verse 25, because it hated me before you even came on the scene. I need to keep hearing messages like this because, I'll be frank with you, it does surprise me. It keeps surprising me. when I even encounter much more mild forms of the strong words that I have up on the screen of hatred, betrayal, rejection. Because I assume when I'm talking with people, interacting with people, I assume that if I'm warm, if I'm sincere, that I will have a reaction of warmth and sincerity coming back to me, but that is not always the case. And so when I encounter coldness and rejection, my knee-jerk reaction is to say, well, that must be my fault. And sometimes it is. Sometimes I haven't seasoned my words with enough salt for the occasion. And so sometimes that requires an apology on my part and making that right. But as I've said before in previous teachings, we have to be very careful to never apologize for the gospel message itself. Because if you are applying it to somebody else's life in ways that they need to hear it, it is not your fault, and it is not God's fault, or the fault of Jesus the King, if they don't want it. And so Jesus says, when you meet somebody who doesn't want it, just move on. If they're not sincere seekers, there's only so much you can do. Go to the next town. Because we have limited time. Yes, we need patience. Yes, we need to have steadfast love in our relationships with other people. And no, we don't need to just cut somebody off at one conversation. Well, that's the end of you. You must not be interested. No, but if somebody remains apathetic, if somebody remains antagonistic, I'm not going to keep beating my head up against a wall. We're going to shake the dust off and we're going to move on. Because there's always going to be somebody else to teach and to love and to serve. You will not have gone through all the towns in Midwest America before the Son of Man comes, is the point of all of this. And by the way, this point that we're talking about what we can expect in the world, doesn't this make us that much more eager to make this place an oasis of honor and support and encouragement? Because if we're finding rejection out there, and then we come here and we find rejection, where else are we going to go for encouragement? We need to work hard at that because of this. So move on if you're going to not find sincere seekers in the town that you're going to. But also, I think we have this idea embedded in the text too, that intense opposition from the broader culture out there, it provides golden opportunities for the good news to spread in ways that it just is not going to spread in times of peace. This is an interesting idea. Now, the apostles are not always going to be teaching fellow Jews, because you notice verse 18 is pretty explicit about this. There aren't a lot of governors and kings amongst the Jews. So someday you're going to be dragged before those type of people. You're going to bear witness in front of Gentiles. Because how is Felix and Drusilla and Festus and some of these, you know, Herod Agrippa and his wife Bernice, how are they going to hear the gospel? Is it going to be because they're going to attend a house church in Jerusalem on a Sunday morning? I don't think so. If they're going to hear the gospel, it's going to be because a Paul in chains steps in front of them with the message on his lips and gives it out to the whole room. In Acts 8, how is the gospel going to spread outside of Jerusalem to eventually Judea and Samaria? Well, isn't it going to be because of the persecution that happens with the stoning of Stephen? The Christians ended up scattering in the next chapter, but they went everywhere preaching the word. Sometimes the very best thing that happens to God's people is they go through really hard days. Because the sincere ones among them will not grow discouraged and silent, they will be increasing in boldness and in the spread of the message. And the church grows as a result. So obviously, according to 1 Timothy 2, we don't pray for persecution. In 1 Timothy 2, we pray for a quiet life so that we can live in unhostile environments. We don't seek ill treatment, but some people are never going to come to Christ unless they see a Christian going through horror. And then they'll change. We have to give that kind of example to the world. Unless a grain of wheat falls into the earth and does what? Dies. Then it remains alone. But if it dies, it bears much fruit. As he says here, whoever loses his life for my sake is going to find it. And that feeds into the next section here of who are you going to fear? You're going to fear somebody. But it's either going to be God or it's going to be scary governors and kings and people yelling at you on the street corner about what you're saying. But I want you to notice the kind of point that he makes, which is similar to what we've seen before in the Sermon on the Mount. He knows what is going on with your life. He has full knowledge of what happens to his children. And we ultimately just answer to God when Judgment Day comes. And so that gives our work boldness and awe at the same time. Did you notice how many times God says, don't be afraid here through Jesus? Verse 19, don't be anxious when you speak in front of these hostile types of crowds. And then verse 26, verse 28, verse 31, all say together, don't be afraid of these wolf type of people. They can't hurt you in any kind of permanent way. Yes, they can do things to the body that God has given you, but they can't touch your resurrection body. They can't touch your soul. They can't touch your eternal destiny. But there is someone who can do all of those things. So rather fear him. But notice in verse 29 and 33, how is God referred to as? He is, yes, we're to fear, but he is described as a father with his kids. Good fathers are aware and they care about what is going on with their kids. And God says here, even the smallest details of your life. It's not as if God just sort of looks over at us when we're going through a really hard time. Now, sometimes, I'd say, as a finite father, sometimes extra attention is drawn to a child when an argument has erupted in this corner of the house, or somebody yells out in pain in this corner of the house. Then it's like, okay, now we're really going to be paying attention to that so that we can solve that or bind that up or whatever we need to do with that. But God has full attention on his kids, us, on every moment of the day, with everything in our lives, even the hairs on our body, he says. He knows the number of them all. In other words, he knows you a lot better than you even know you, which is a crazy thing and is so full of comfort for us. He knows when you're being mistreated. Because, notice what he says here, he even knows when the sparrows die. Did you know that if you went to an average first century marketplace, the sparrows that you would be able to buy there were the cheapest things in the marketplace? I guess there were just a crazy amount of sparrows back then in their part of the world. And one sparrow was worth 1/16 of a denarius, which is less than a half hour's average wage. There, maybe in modern day parlance, we would say they're kind of a dime a dozen. You know, they're just not worth much of anything. If he knows about sparrows, and he knows what happens to them, how much more? The same argument we've seen, Sermon on the Mount. How much more does he know and care about you? And so it's interesting to me that in this context, in this section about who are we supposed to fear, it's not them, it's him, then he talks about our worthiness of discipleship. And our worthiness depends on whether we value him. He values us, hairs on the head, sparrows, all that business. Do we value him above everybody else around us? You know, it's rare for Jesus to frame a teaching in terms of worthiness, isn't it? Whether or not we deserve him. Now, if you did not have your Bible open to this place, and I just asked you the simple question, do you deserve to follow Jesus? I think all of us would just automatically say, well, no, none of us deserve. None of us are worthy of being his man or his woman. It's kind of jarring to think about that, because on our own merits, none of us measure up, but because of his sacrifice, he looks at us and counts us as righteous. Go to Romans, especially, for that kind of thinking. Even though we don't deserve to be justified, he does that because of what he does on the cross. But can we undo that blessing? Yes, we can. In this context, what makes us unworthy? It's by not honoring him above the other humans that we really, really care about. Remember, that was Eli's problem that we just studied about in the book of Samuel. Remember, God told him, you have honored your sons above me by fattening yourselves on the choicest parts of every offering. In other words, Eli, even though you may not have gotten your fork to stick it in that pot, you let them do it without consequence, and so you have, by default, participated in their evil because you did not stop it and restrain them, even though you had the authority to do that. There are a lot of nuances to talk through and to think about when it comes to our human relationships. But at the bare minimum, we need to make this point that our spouse, our kids, our parents, our children, our, verse 35, our in-laws, he mentions them here, your best friends, whoever you have, human-wise, everybody around you needs to understand that every decision I'm going to make is with Jesus in mind first. How can I put him first? And that's going to be uncomfortable sometimes. Because maybe you're going to make different judgment calls about some things than family members are going to make. Maybe you're going to have other goals that maybe other family members aren't going to follow that kind of sets you apart and makes you stick out like a sore thumb. That discomfort is inherent. It's a feature, not a bug. Jesus says, verse 38, welcome to take your cross and follow me. How comfortable is that going to be? Not very. I don't think we can emphasize this kind of point enough about him coming first. If there is sin in your family and your family is circling the wagons, and your family is closing ranks, and your family is refusing to do anything about the problem that everybody in the family knows about, you have to be the one to stand up and say, this is wrong. And we need to pull in other people to help us figure this out and do something about this. Because sometimes behind closed doors, when the Sunday suits and outfits are taken off And we go our separate ways from this structure. Sometimes behind closed doors, there are terrible things that happen in the households of people who call themselves Christians. Secret abuse of wives, of kids. And when nothing is reported by those who know, it is because often Satan has whispered, "Don't embarrass the family." And the family believes him. And sometimes a church knows that something needs to be done about someone in its ranks. But sometimes nothing happens because Satan has whispered, "Don't embarrass the church. Got to keep up the reputation." And the church believes him. Jesus says through Paul, "Take no part in the unfruitful works of darkness, but instead expose them." Draw the curtain back. As painful as that might be at the time, this is the way of the good news, because Jesus says here, what did he come for? I came to bring what? A sword, not peace. Now, isn't he the Prince of Peace? According to Isaiah, of course he is. But the kind of peace that he brings is not a peace that glosses over sins in order to maintain some sort of superficial harmony. Harmony's got to be deeply rooted in truth and love and service if it's going to be real. And so we've got to be okay with serving a Lord whose teachings are going to naturally divide us from other people, sometimes even from people who are close to us. Because if you want to be called his disciple, if you want to be worthy, he says it very clearly here, you got to love me above all. So then we get to the last part of this teaching, this last part of this instruction for his apostles. And I think it's interesting how he ends this, with kind of going back to the idea of you're going to go out into the world and some people are going to receive you and some people are not. For the people who do receive you, for the people who, you know, they open their door and they hear what you have to say and they want that and they welcome you in and they let you come to their table and sit you down, those people are going to be not just accepting of you, but follow the chain, accepting of God himself. Because he says here, they accept you, they accept me because I sent you. And if that person is accepting me, then that draws a line of connection to God himself. I think everybody has prophets in their life. Not necessarily somebody who is receiving supernatural messages from God himself to whisper into your ear. But we have prophets in our life in the sense that we've got people around us, and this is the construction and the design for a local church. We've got people around us who can speak to us words from God when we need it in applicable ways. And so it might be tempting sometimes to look at the prophets around us and say, I don't need to hear that. Who made you God? Well, no, but we're not God. None of us are. All of us are flawed in different kinds of ways. No, I certainly am. But all of us need to realize, I need to accept, I need to receive, I need to welcome the prophets in my life, whoever they might be, if they are teaching me more about how to love him and serve him. Are we doing that? And that kind of relates to this other point here that we see in this part, that even small acts of kindness that you might give to somebody as a way of receiving, as a way of welcoming, as a way of helping, that God sees that. And that no action in that kind of boat is going to be overlooked by him or unrewarded. I love the picture in verse 42. And the cup of cold water was embedded in one of the songs that we sang as well. It doesn't seem like a big deal, does it? A cup of cold water. Especially in our modern day where you can just go to the tap, you just go to the filter, and boom, there it is. But if you're living in ancient times, and you have been in the field for a whole day, and you haven't been right by the well, and your water skin has long run out hours ago, and you're sunburnt, and you're really, really tired, and you're really, really thirsty, or you've spent a whole day on the road, on a hot, dry, dusty road, usually walking in sandals, and your water skin has run out hours ago. When you get to your lodging place at the end of the day, a cup of cold water is what you want more than anything else in the world at that particular moment in time. When you have something to give, sometimes it may not look like much. But in God's providence, he can arrange those gifts to be given in ways that mean the world to the person who is receiving them at the time that they are given. I think I've mentioned this before, but sometimes in my ministry life, God has arranged things such that I was given just a few words at needed moments of my life to help me keep going on my road. I'm sure that you can look at your road, you can look at your life, and you could probably say the same thing. They're just little cups of cold water for little ones. He mentions little ones here. I don't think he's literally just talking about children. I think he's referring to these guys who are being sent out who are little in terms of the way that the world looks at people. They're not the kind of people that are going to make the news. They don't have high positions in the world. They're unimportant, but they're quietly going about doing kingdom work. Are we paying attention to the little ones around us? Because they need to be noticed, and they need to be loved and appreciated. And if you reward them, then God is going to reward you as well. Because this is all a part of finding our lives, trying to find our lives. And the way that we do that is by losing them. The king calls you to give up what you cannot keep in order to gain what you cannot lose. I wish I could say I came up with that. I did not. I stole that from a missionary named Jim Elliot. You may have heard that name or not. Jim Elliot was a missionary to the Auca Indians in Ecuador, I believe in the 50s. And he wrote this, I believe, in one of his journal entries before he was speared to death by the Indians that he went to preach to. This is what Jesus very clearly says, not just here, but also if you flip over to chapter 16, we're going to see this again. This is not just a part of this passage. In 16:25, in another passage about taking up your cross, denying yourself, following me, same message there too, because he says there in 16:25, whoever would save his life will lose it. Whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. For what will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and forfeits his soul? Or what shall a man give in return for his soul? For the Son of Man is going to come with his angels in the glory of his Father, and he will repay each person according to what he's done. Truly I say to you, there's some standing here who will not taste death until they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom. Are you willing to lose your life for the sake of Jesus. Maybe, eventually, that will mean dying in a South American jungle in dramatic kinds of ways. But more often than not, it looks like really hard daily sacrifice of what you want, of the kinds of things you would like to put on your calendar, but you don't because your calendar is already full of acts of service for somebody else, et cetera, et cetera. In just a moment, we're going to sing the song that Brent has asked us to mark, I believe number 615. But in this moment, I want you to think about you and how you relate to this. Because if you're not someone who has said, I'm going to serve Jesus for the rest of my life, and I am sorry for the ways that I have failed him, and I want to be buried in water so that my sins can be washed away, not because of some great action of mine, but because that's where he does spiritual surgery and cuts off the foreskins of our hearts. If you haven't obeyed the gospel yet, if you have not become a Christian, then you need to. If you have not become a disciple yet in that action, then you still are trying to live your life for yourself. Give it up, though. Die. Die. So that you can live. Think about your life, and if we can help you this morning in any way, let us know. Stand up and sing the invitation song.